Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
People have always sought ecstatic experiences, moments where they go beyond their ordinary self and feel connected to something greater than them. Such moments are fundamental to human flourishing, but they can also be dangerous. Beginning around the Enlightenment, Western intellectual culture has kind of written off ecstasy as ignorance or delusion. But philosopher Jules Evans argues that this diminishes our reality and denies us the healing, connection, and meaning that ecstasy can bring. In his book, The Art of Losing Control, A Philosopher's Search for Ecstatic Experience, he sets out to discover how people can find ecstasy in a post-religious culture, how it can be good for us, and also harmful. Along the way, he explores the growing science of ecstasy to help the reader and himself learn the art of losing control. Evans' exploration of ecstasy is an intellectual and emotional odyssey drawing on personal experience, interviews, and readings from ancient and modern philosophers. From Aristotle and Plato, via the Bishop of London and Sister Bliss, radical jihadis, and Silicon Valley transhumanists, The Art of Losing Control is a funny and thought-provoking journey through underexplored terrain, which Evans creatively maps out like a tour through a festival, with stops at the major pavilions along the way, complete with a cutely drawn festival map at the front of the book. Jules Evans is a policy director at the Center for the History of Emotions at Queen Mary University of London. He's the author of Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, which was published in 19 countries and was a Times Book of the Year. Evans has written for The Times, Financial Times, The Guardian, Spectator, and Wired, and is a BBC New Generation thinker. He also runs the London Philosophy Club, the world's biggest philosophy club. He joins me today to discuss his new book. Hello, my name is Carrie Lynn Evans, and you're listening to New Books in Secularism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, my guest is philosopher Jules Evans, who's agreed to talk with us about his book, The Art of Losing Control, A Philosopher's Search for Ecstatic Experience. Jules, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
First, I want to start by asking you a bit about yourself. You have your fingers in a number of philosophical pies, it seems, and you also have a fairly harrowing story about a pivotal moment in your life. Can you tell us how you came to be involved in the things you're doing today?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, the short version is that I got into writing, I got into philosophy and psychology because I had some emotional problems when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. My friends and I were quite kind of reckless experimenters with psychedelic drugs when we were teenagers. So we were like 90s hippies. And we had some like fun times with that. But by the time I was 18, through some a couple of bad trips on LSD, I developed what was later diagnosed as social anxiety and post-traumatic stress. And so I had a firsthand experience of how our minds and our emotions can really mess us up. I was very much at the mercy of these negative emotions and was very confused and suffering, I would say, from about the age of 18 to 24. And then, I mean, I, I was helped by various things, including cognitive behavioral therapy. And I wrote my first book about how cognitive behavioral therapy came from Greek philosophy. So I became very interested in that and the idea of the ancient Greek and Roman idea of philosophy as a medicine for the mind. People like Socrates or the Stoics thought of philosophy as a form of therapy, a form of care for the soul. So my first book, which was called Philosophy for Life and Other Dangerous Situations, was about how people can use ancient Greek philosophy today as a means to flourish and as a kind of consolation for difficult times. And I was very involved with the revival of Stoic philosophy in modern life. I organized the first gathering of Stoics probably for about 2,000 years. That was in San Diego in 2011. And I organized two conferences known as Stoicons. But by the time I'd finished that first book, I felt that Stoic philosophy wasn't, and kind of rational Greek philosophy wasn't quite enough for me, and that it missed out certain important things. I felt that it was a bit over individualistic and over rationalistic, and that it missed out things like romantic love and festivity and dancing and the imagination. And also it missed out the kind of ecstatic experiences and that whole domain of human experience. So I started to research that and spent about 5 years exploring that area of human experience.
Okay. So to begin, let's talk about what you mean by ecstasy. You write that our contemporary Western culture has a problematic relationship with ecstasy and that we have a materialistic worldview that denigrates ecstatic experiences and that this narrows and impoverishes our experiences of reality. So tell us what you mean here.
So I define an ecstatic experience. I'm talking about a type of experience which, on the whole, psychologists don't talk about much. They tend to just ignore it. When they do talk about it, they use different terminologies. So William James, the psychologist William James, he wrote about this area of experience and he used the phrase religious experiences. He wrote this famous book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Other psychologists might talk about transcendent experiences or flow states or altered states of consciousness. But I like the phrase ecstatic experience, which comes from the ancient Greek word ecstasis, which literally means standing outside. So an ecstatic experience is a moment when you stand outside your ordinary sense of self, your ordinary sense of who you are and how reality is. And you feel often a deep connection to something greater than you. Now, in classical cultures and in medieval culture, that would usually be interpreted as a connection to God or to some kind of supernatural power. But I was interested in how people find those kinds of ecstatic experiences in modern Western culture and how they make sense of them. And they might not necessarily interpret them in a religious way. So you might feel an ecstatic connection to nature or to the universe or to other beings or to a particular person or group of people. Now, ecstatic experiences can often, nowadays we often, when we hear the word ecstatic, we often think it means very, very happy. So if you Google ecstatic, you probably get results from the sports news. It'll say things like, you know, Mets fans ecstatic after victory. But actually, ecstasy in the traditional sense of the word can involve things like euphoria and deep happiness and serenity, but it can also be quite frightening because you're going outside your ordinary sense of self. You're to some extent kind of surrendering control and feeling connected to something in some ways much greater and much more powerful than you. So it can also be scary as well. And I guess my basic question is there's two parts to the book really. There's a historical aspect to it. So I argue that Western culture has rather marginalized ecstatic experience and particularly religious ecstasy over the last 300 years as we shifted to a more kind of materialist and disenchanted worldview. And we've rather pathologized ecstatic experiences. So modern psychiatry has often basically labeled ecstatic experiences as mental illnesses and called it things like hysteria or a symptom of psychosis or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. So as a result, there's often a kind of taboo around ecstatic experiences. We might have them, but we don't really like talking about them to other people. So I guess I want to know, how can we find this kind of experience? When is it good for us and when is it bad for us?
Right. And you mentioned the 1960s actually as a period that saw a revival of ecstatic practices, such that Charles Taylor characterized our current state as a spiritual supernova. And it would seem now that we're perhaps living in the hangover of this supernova. So please tell us what Taylor meant by that term.
Yeah. So, I mean, he wrote this book, A Secular Age, about our shift to a more kind of secular worldview. But he said, we still seek transcendence. We still seek to go beyond our ordinary egos. We found different ways to do that. So he saw what happened in the 60s as just a sudden explosion of different forms of ecstatic practices into Western culture. Not just a revival of Christianity by any means, but instead all these different types of practices, things like Eastern contemplative practices, things like psychedelic drugs, things like you think about kind of rock and roll or the sexual revolution, and then also some rather darker things like cults or extremist movements, which were also in a way tapping into people's desire for these intense experiences. So there was, you know, there was this kind of almost an ecstatic wave swept through Western cultures in the 1960s. It was this explosion, but it was often in quite a, you know, uncontained and even dangerous forms. So you had things like, you know, cult leaders, or you had the hangover from the sexual revolution, or you had a lot of people getting into problems through reckless experimentation with psychedelics. And I think what's happening now is almost, it's like a second wave after the 1960s, but in a rather more mature, careful, measured way.
All right, so let's go to the entrance gate. You've laid out your book like a festival with a number of tents. And the first stop on our tour of the Festival of Ecstasy is the religious experience at the entrance gate. So you explain that there are three different types of these religious experiences. Can you tell us about them and about how they can be both positive and negative for the people experiencing them?
Yeah, I don't think I use the term religious experience. I think I called it kind of spontaneous ecstatic experience. Isn't that right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
In the first chapter. Yeah. So basically, I definitely don't want to call them religious, because the whole point about these experiences is not everyone makes sense of them in religious ways. But basically, a spontaneous spiritual experience is an experience that you don't necessarily seek. So for most of the chapters in the book, I'm talking about people actively seeking these kinds of experiences. But spontaneous experiences are things that just happen to you. So let's say you're just walking down the street, or you're walking through Yosemite National Park or something, and you suddenly feel a shift in your consciousness, and you feel maybe a deep sense of connection to your surroundings or connection to other people. And these moments can happen just out of nowhere, and yet they can really change people and be very important for their lives. So I collected, accounts of different people's experiences like this. For example, the rationalist philosopher Bertrand Russell was walking down the street in London one day, and then something happened. For some reason, he suddenly felt what he called a moment of mystical illumination. And he felt a deep sense of connection and sympathy for the strangers walking around him. And that moment really changed him for the rest of his life. It didn't make him a Christian. He didn't interpret it that way. He remained a kind of fervent atheist his whole life. But he became much more humanitarian. Before that experience, he was kind of an imperialist. And afterwards, he was a committed pacifist. So there are lots of examples of these kinds of spontaneous experience which can happen to people. And of course, sometimes they wonder what the hell it is. And they might not have the vocabulary for them. This just strange shift in their consciousness, this strange sudden sense of fullness and connectedness and aliveness. And they might think, what the hell was that? And sometimes those experiences are just a kind of a glimpse of a deeper life and a deeper sense of connection to your environment. And people act on them and are very changed by them. And then sometimes they just happen and people don't know what to make of them. So they don't necessarily change you because you don't really, you know, work to integrate the experience. So I talked about that. I talked, I think, in that chapter as well about near-death experiences, which are a similar kind of thing. You know, you might have a serious illness or a cardiac arrest or be in an accident, and suddenly you feel your consciousness has shifted to somewhere else. You might feel kind of in a connection to some kind of higher power or some kind of white light type experience. And there's quite good scientific research on this now. There's now, you know, these experiences are surprisingly common and they often share some features, even in different cultures. So I became interested in that topic of near-death experiences and to some extent interested in this whole area of ecstatic experiences because I had I guess you could call it a near-death experience. When I was about 24, I was in a bad skiing accident. I actually kind of fell off a cliff when I was skiing. At the moment of impact, you know, I had this kind of classic experience, which I now realize is quite common with other people, of feeling in connection with some kind of white light and feeling you know, deeply loved and restored. So that was a tremendously kind of, it sounds strange to say it, but it was a very positive experience for me, that bad skiing accident. And I was quite changed by it. So again, that was an experience I sought. I wasn't seeking to go through the fence on the side of this mountain by mistake. It was spontaneous. It was unexpected, but it was still very healing.
So let's move on to the next stop on the tour, which you call the Revival Tent. And this takes the ecstasy of the spontaneous experience from the ultra-personal into the group setting. So you talk about how this manifests in certain kinds of Christian churches in particular. Tell us about your experiences here.
Well, I guess I was interested in a type of Christianity called charismatic Christianity, which is a Christianity that's very open to the Holy Spirit and really has a place for an ecstatic type of experience. So you see that in churches like the old 18th century Methodist churches, where they would very much open themselves to what they, you know, kind of Holy Spirit type encounters. You see it in movements like the Quakers, another 18th century movement. You see it in the Pentecostalists of the kind of 20th century churches. And then in neo-Pentecostal churches as well. And I, living in Britain, which I guess is, I don't know about Canada, but it's probably quite different to America. Britain is an incredibly, incredibly secular country. Only, I think, less than 2% of the population go to church every week. So I was interested in kind of these like ecstatic Christian churches as whether they're a place where people can go to find ecstatic experiences within these rather emotional services where there's a lot of singing and dancing and then rather dramatic preaching. And then when people pray in these kinds of churches, they are opening themselves to the Holy Spirit, inviting the Holy Spirit in. And then, you know, they will often have ecstatic type experiences of healing or of inspiration or prophecy. And so to research this, I went along to a famous church in London called Holy Trinity Brompton, which is the home of something called the Alpha Course. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's like, it's very popular. I mean, it's like millions of people around the world have done it. And some of it is just like, you know, you sit around, you get given some nice food, you talk about your life. It's all pretty normal in a way. It's just a nice kind of, you know, weekly group meeting. But then towards the end of the course, they try to help you to have a kind of Holy Spirit encounter. They get you to invite the Holy Spirit in. So it was kind of peculiar in a way. But to cut a long story short, I ended up becoming a Christian. While researching this book, I kind of I had an ecstatic encounter myself in a church in Wales, surrounded by ecstatic pensioners. It was, you know, very peculiar situation, but I guess I in some ways was caught up in the experience and was to some extent seeking it as well, and so I ended up converting to Christianity and announcing my conversion on my blog, to the horror of most of my readers, because they were mainly rational Stoics who followed me because of my first book. And then there I am going, I'm a Christian. And so like about a third of my readers unsubscribed immediately. You know, and then even more tragically, after about a year, I decided I wasn't a Christian. I decided that there were basic aspects of it I couldn't believe, and I was just kidding myself. So then I felt even more confused. But, you know, it's a very interesting experience to look back on. And I do still think about it a lot, about what exactly happened to me in that church. And is Christianity, I mean, it's, you know, in some ways, it is a framework in which which helps people to go beyond themselves. It's a framework which helps them through things like community and ritual and music and prayer, transcend their ordinary egos and feel a sense of connection both to each other. So I was struck by how strong a sense of community there is in some churches, and to some kind of higher something or other, which you could call God. And of course, the model of God that they try to help people connect at its best is a kind of loving God, though of course, I guess not always. Sometimes it's a rather, you know, it's a rather crappy version of God that they make people encounter, a rather judgmental God. So it was just a strange year in my life, really. And I come away from it. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in that church anymore. And I kind of think how funny I was in it in a way for a year. But I still have, I guess, more respect for my Christian friends. And I see the point of what they're doing in a way. And, you know, when I look, I guess they are still providing spaces where people can go to go beyond their egos. And I think we lack those kind of spaces in secular British culture. So rather than just laugh at Christians, I think it's interesting to think, what do they get right? And how can we, if we're not Christian, create those kinds of spaces for community and for transcendence, which helps people to go beyond themselves in safe ways? Because of course, sometimes places where people go for self-transcendence can be a bit toxic. Do you know what I mean? Say, right, we're going to help you find transcendence. Now just give us all your money. Or we'll help you find transcendence. Now all you've got to do is hate gay people or hate other religions or something like that. Do you know what I mean? So can we as a culture develop places where people can find community and self-transcendence in ways that aren't exploitative, which aren't dangerous, which aren't toxic? I think that's an important question for our culture.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. Mm. Well, on the next stop on our tour, you call this the ecstatic cinema. And here you look at the potential healing power of art in connection with Carl Jung's views about the subconscious. So how do these three elements of art, psychology, and ecstatic experience come together?
Well, as religion declined in Europe over since about the 17th century, many people lost that avenue to self-transcendence, the avenue of the church. And so people looked around for substitutes, for alternative avenues to self-transcendence. And one of the most popular alternative avenues that people have found is the arts. Many people say that if you ask them, I've done surveys on this, have you ever had a self-transcendent or spiritual or ecstatic experience? And many people, when they talk about those kinds of moments for themselves, they say that they got them through the arts. Maybe it was watching a particular film, like, I don't know, Stanley Kubrick's 2001. Some people say that the first time they saw that film was a kind of spiritual experience for them. Maybe it was walking through a gallery or a cathedral or a beautiful piece of architecture. You suddenly felt just kind of gripped or transported, and your consciousness shifted. I remember the first time I saw Florence, the skyline of Florence. I was 14 years old, and I walked through, I was outside Florence, I walked through an olive grove, and I suddenly saw the skyline of this beautiful Renaissance city. And I've never forgotten that moment, because it expanded my sense of the of what beauty could be. So it kind of changed me, that moment. Or it might be perhaps a poem that you read, maybe when you were a teenager, maybe something like Emily Dickinson or Walt Whitman. And you'll always remember that moment and how you felt when you first read that poem. So these kinds of experiences can be very transformative for people. For a lot of people, of course, music is their main way to this type of experience. I mean, I talk about that in the next chapter, so I won't talk about that here. But I mean, I don't know about you, Carrie. Have you is that something you can relate to? I mean, is that have you ever found a work of art or a book or something like that has ever kind of really had a deep impact on you and given you a kind of epiphany type experience?
Well, it's funny you mention it, because I spent my third year of university in London and discovered the great big clubs and the great big Basie experience that you can have in those clubs. And so I've always been deeply connected to bass music ever since. I've tried to.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Yeah, you mentioned that a little bit in your book, and I thought that was cool. But yeah, for me, when you're exported, like you talk about the unselfing, when you're in one of those places that's engineered to be able to generate that frequency of bass that reverberates your entire body. For me, that is an out-of-body experience entirely.
That's amazing. So what are we talking about? Are we talking about places like the Ministry of Sound? Or
Yeah. I've been to Fabric. I can't remember them all now.
Okay. Well, so that's interesting. Yeah. So for you, sometimes when we talk about these kinds of experiences of transcendence, it sounds very kind of up in the air. It can do, a bit like, you know, airy fairy kind of thing. But as you're saying, often it's very somatic, isn't it?
It is for me.
It can be a very deep bodied thing. And that's true for a lot of them. I mean, like, say, if you look at these ecstatic Christian churches, like Pentecostal churches, it's very embodied and physical. You know, they'll be kind of almost shaking with these kinds of experiences. Likewise, with music and dancing and the arts as well, it can be a very full-bodied thing. Like, say you listening to a piece of music or you read a poem and you feel the kind of hair standing up on your skin and a kind of tingling. So it is indeed very somatic. I mean, just to hop on to the next chapter,
sure,
just because it's connected to what you were saying, the next chapter I look at music as a means to ecstasy, and rock and roll, jazz, rave music. I think it's been one of the most important kind of substitutes or alternatives to the church, particularly since the 1960s. And I look at the history of rock and roll in the book and the relationship between rock and roll and Pentecostalism. So how, in a way, rock and roll and rhythm and blues music came from the church, from the Pentecostal church, how a lot of the great pioneers of rhythm and blues, James Brown, Ray Charles, Tina Turner, Elvis Presley, Little Richard, they kind of started off in the church, and then they took a lot of the kind of emotion and the ecstasy of Pentecostal religion, and they kind of secularized it and sexualized it and turned it into rock and roll. And that gave white middle-class agnostic kids a way into that embodied ecstasy, that fusion of kind of Christianity with African rhythms. So it kind of created a church for the unchurched. And certainly, like, I guess for me growing up, some of the most powerful, I would say, spiritual experiences I had was like going raving. I mean, I was, this was in the mid 90s. So this was, an amazing golden age for electronic dance music in the UK. And I remember going along to kind of, raves and just the feeling of togetherness with kind of strangers and this all night journeys of just kind of dancing to the music. And of course we were altering our consciousness with drugs as well. So we were doing things like MDMA and psychedelics. And these were just unforgettable nights, really. And I felt so bonded to my friends as well. We'll still talk about them 20 years later, these nights. So I guess I was interested in rock and roll and other forms of pop music as a really important means to self transcendence and to collective transcendence. And I interview in this chapter musicians like David Byrne, who's the lead singer of Talking Heads, and Brian Eno, who produced Talking Heads, and those two, they're so clever. They're such intellectuals, and they both thought very deeply about ecstatic experience and how music helps us to this kind of experience and how music can be a kind of alternative to religion, because neither of them are religious. So it was fascinating to talk to them about it. Yeah.
It seems, too, like religion, or I mean, the music would be a way to achieve those kinds of experiences in ways that would maybe have fewer of the negative impacts. I mean, aside from the drugs, assuming that that's not necessarily part of it, but because you were saying before about the difficulty of achieving that without some of the negatives that can come along with it. And it seems like music may be one of those where.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, one of my great heroes when I was researching this book was Aldous Huxley. I just did a talk about him last night, for example. And I just think he's an incredible, the greatest analyst we have about self-transcendence. And he said that, all avenues to self-transcendence can potentially be a bit dangerous and unhealthy, because we're talking about, a slightly messy aspect of human experience, unselfing, going beyond the self. You're talking about, opening up your psyche. You're talking about surrendering ego control. So it can be very, very healing and very, very meaningful, like some of the most meaningful experiences in your life. But it can also be a bit messy. It can be a bit risky. And that's true of any avenue you take. So even something like aesthetic ecstasy or ecstasy through the arts, I mean, that sounds fairly riskless, but that even that has its risks too. For example, you could use the arts as a way of to ecstasy, but it ends up just being escapism, as a way of not confronting your life. So you escape into novels, or you just escape into watching endless sci-fi repeats, or you just kind of Netflix and chill, you know, like, so even ecstasy or self-transcendence through the arts can be a form of just unhealthy or addictive escapism. And if you look at music, in a way, the problem about treating, say, rock and roll or rave music as a substitute for religion is that, yes, it gives you some of the aspects of religion. It gives you that ecstatic experience sometimes. But what does it not give you? It doesn't always give you genuine, deep community. I mean, yes, I felt an incredible sense of community for 6 hours while I was on MDMA at a rave. But, you know, I didn't really stay in touch with any of the people I was raving with. And we weren't really, you know, we were just there for the highs. We weren't really supporting each other through the difficult moments in life. Also, there's a risk of looking to pop stars to be kind of preachers or to be spiritual leaders. And I think that's what the 60s kind of tried to do. They tried to look to people like the Beatles or John Lennon particularly, or to Bob Dylan, to be these kinds of spiritual guides for them. And I don't know if you've ever seen this great documentary, No Direction Home by Martin Scorsese. It's all about Bob Dylan. And you see Dylan really, really uncomfortable in the role that his generation has put him in. He said, I don't know what you should do with your lives. I'm just a singer. He's a poet, really. So that's another issue with trying to make music a substitute for religion is sometimes that's a tremendous pressure to put on musicians who are mainly there just to kind of sing and create. They're not there to be spiritual guides for you. And I think a third problem with trying to make music or the arts some kind of substitute for religion is music and the arts gives you a window beyond the self. It gives you a glimpse of something greater than your little ego, a window beyond it. But it doesn't really give you a ladder to transform yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like to actually not just glimpse beyond your ego, but transform your ego, that takes like practice. That takes a kind of daily practice. And I think wisdom, I mean, let's not use the word religions. Let's just say wisdom traditions. Wisdom traditions like Buddhism, say, or Christian wisdom, or even things like Greek philosophy, I think they can give you both the kind of window beyond the ego, but also a kind of practices for that daily work that can help you transform it, because it is very slow work. So I guess what I'm saying is I think that music and the arts are a really important part of the picture. And you can see that if you go to any kind of religious ceremony around the world, they will use religion, they will use the arts, they will use poetry. But I don't know if they're enough on their own. They tend to work best in coordination with other things. We still need those kinds of daily practices for the slow work of transforming ourselves. Does that make sense?
It does. And let's turn back to drugs, because in fact, your next chapter, you talk more about drugs. You call that your psychedelic wonderland on the stop on your tour. And there's actually a positive side to the use of drugs in ecstatic practice as well. We know that it's been used throughout history for ritualistic significance and so forth. So tell us a little bit maybe about the more positive side of the drugs.
Yeah, well, obviously, I've had firsthand experience of the kind of negative side of drugs, and particularly of psychedelics. So I had these bad trips when I was 18, which hurt me for a while. But I was interested, while I was researching this book, to see that there has been a kind of renaissance in scientific research into psychedelics over the last 13 years or so. So respected research centers like the Johns Hopkins Medical College, like Imperial College in London, like Zurich University in Switzerland, have restarted research into psychedelics, by which I mean drugs like LSD and magic mushrooms and ketamine, after pretty much a 40-year hiatus. So, back in the 60s, of course, there was this explosion of interest in psychedelics done in a very rather chaotic and over-evangelical way. I mean, most infamously, you had the Harvard psychologist Timothy Leary saying that everyone in America should take LSD. Every teenager should take LSD, calling himself the prophet of a new religion of LSD. So he got himself, he would throw parties at Harvard where he was giving LSD to undergraduates. So he got himself rapidly fired from Harvard and then public enemy number one by Richard Nixon. And he had to go on the run. He was then, actually, it was an extraordinary story. He was put in prison and then he was bussed out of prison by this kind of terrorist group called the Weathermen. He was actually, he was in the prison cell next to Charles Manson, who used LSD in his kind of crazy cult. So that is an interesting,
my goodness,
there between Timothy Leary and Charles Manson. Anyway, as you can tell, Leary really ruined the reputation of psychedelics, and so they were banned even for research purposes, which was a great pity because early research in the 1950s and 60s. Found they could, when they were used carefully, be very therapeutic for people. And what's happened in the last 15 years is research has started again, but in a much quieter and more careful and measured way by respected scientists who are very careful not to tell everyone to do LSD, for example. And they've had good results in some of these early trials. So they found that, one dose of psilocybin, which is the psychedelic chemical in magic mushrooms, one dose of that helped a lot of people, something like 40% of people in a trial to recover from treatment-resistant depression. So these were people who hadn't responded to any other treatment like cognitive therapy or Prozac. There was another trial that found 80% of smokers after two doses of psilocybin or of magic mushrooms gave up smoking, which was far higher than any other kinds of method. Another trial found that one psychedelic trip helped people who were suffering from life-threatening cancer to feel much less depressed and anxious. So it seemed to even shift their attitude to death, at least either to make them much more accepting of it or to make them open to the possibility that maybe death in some way wasn't the end. And when they were making sense of, so this is remarkable, really. I mean, so a lot of psychiatrists are very excited by psychedelics because psychiatrists haven't really found any new successful drugs to treat emotional and mental problems since Prozac in the 1980s. So there's a lot of interest in these new psychedelic drugs as a treatment for emotional and behavioral problems. In fact, last week, the FDA in America approved a new ketamine-type drug for depression. The FDA is looking at approving MDMA for post-traumatic stress. And I am pretty confident that other types of psychedelics like magic mushrooms and possibly LSD will be approved for the treatment of things like depression and anxiety and possibly addiction. So I'm surprised by how fast it's moving, really. And so the question, maybe some of your listeners are wondering, is how then do these drugs do this? Well, the interesting thing is the scientists studying it say that what these drugs do is give people what some scientists call an experience of ego dissolution and what other scientists call a mystical type experience. So scientists in London call it ego dissolution because they don't really like the word mystical. They think that sounds too kind of spiritual. While scientists in the States, particularly at Johns Hopkins and NYU, they prefer to talk about mystical type experiences. They see it in a more spiritual thing. But in fact, they're talking about a similar kind of experience, which is that what psychedelics seem to do is we tend, put it this way, in our ordinary egos, we're often quite stuck in habits. We can be stuck in the habit of rumination, for example, thinking a lot about ourselves and our problems and our faults. And we can get stuck in a rather negative habitual story about who we are and how the world is. Like I'm no good. I'm a failure. I'm an addict, for example. And what psychedelics seem to do is to kind of dissolve our ordinary sense of ego, dissolve that ordinary habitual story that we tell about ourselves. And they give people often a deep sense of connection to something greater than them, like connection to their deeper self or connection to all things or connection to the universe. So in that sense, it's very similar to a lot of these other types of ecstatic experience that I'm talking about. And out of that ego dissolution, people often feel a sense of insight and power to see where their old habitual, their old habits were messing them up, and to say, for some reason or other, a kind of freedom to choose a different story, a freedom to choose to live their life a different way. To say, right, I'm not going to be addicted to smoking anymore, or perhaps I'm not going to be so afraid of death, or I have no need to be so depressed anymore. So it kind of dissolves our old rigid habits and creates a space for new habits, for neuroplasticity to emerge. One scientist compares it to, like, let's say your habitual thoughts are like habitual ski tracks down a mountain, and they've kind of become very ingrained, so everyone follows the same habitual route. And a psychedelic experience, or indeed any ecstatic experience, is like shaking up the snow so that new routes can be created, new neural pathways. So, I mean, in a way, this is similar to a lot of these other types of ecstatic experience that I talk about in the book. I think sometimes when people are talking or writing about psychedelics, they can get obsessed with them and fixated with them and think that psychedelics is the only route to these kinds of spiritual or mystical experiences. In fact, no, as we've discussed, there are many different routes. But I would say that psychedelics are a very reliable route. You don't know every time you go to church or every time you go to a rock festival or every time, you know, you go to a gallery that you're going to, whether you're going to have an ecstatic experience. But you can be pretty sure you probably are if you take, say, magic mushrooms or LSD within the right setting. You're probably going to have some kind of altered state of consciousness, some kind of experience of ego dissolution. But of course, there are risks to it as well. In all these kinds of experiences, I mean, what psychedelic researchers say is you have to pay attention to what they call the set and the setting. The set means the intention that you bring to the experience. Are you taking psychedelics just for a fun time? Are you taking it just for ego aggrandizement? How strong, how good is your intention? So that can make a big difference. And secondly, the setting. Are you taking psychedelics in a setting that's conducive to a positive healing experience? I think back to when I had my bad trip when I was 18. I was doing LSD at a kind of warehouse rave where I didn't know anyone. I was already quite strung out because I'd been doing too many drugs that summer. So really, I had a bad set and a bad setting. And it wasn't surprising I had a rather bad trip. So researchers say, you know, you should be careful about trying to do it among, you know, friends of yours in a safe place, in a very calm, peaceful place with a good intention. And then you're more likely to have a positive healing experience.
All right. Well, let's move on to contemplation. You trace the decline of contemplative practice in Christianity, starting in the Enlightenment period, as you mentioned, through to the popularization of Eastern meditation techniques that have become popular in the 20th century. So maybe give us an overview of these developments and tell us where we are now with the so-called mindfulness.
Well, yes. So as you say, there is this decline of contemplation in Western culture. If you look at medieval culture, there is this idea of there being two important activities in a Christian's life. There was la vita activa, or the active life, which is trying to do good works. And then there was la vita contemplativa, which was the inner life, trying to do work on yourself. So there was an idea of balancing outer work and inner work. But then there was this sudden, disastrous, in a way, decline of contemplation through the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. So in Britain, for example, Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries. He shut down something like 800 monasteries over a two-year space. So we had this, we lost within 2 years this whole kind of infrastructure, this, all these maps and guides for inner exploration. We lost all these techniques for contemplation. And we ended up with a culture very much focused on the outside world, on controlling and exploiting the external environment, but with very few resources for understanding our inner selves. You know, very few maps. We had to wait until psychodynamic psychology for the works of people like Freud and Jung. And even then, they were often far less psychologically sophisticated and literate than what we found in contemplative wisdom traditions in, say, Buddhism or Hinduism or Christianity. There was this, I think it was very sad, loss of contemplation in Western culture. And it was in, it was unsustainable, that situation, because as Carl Jung said, we were such strangers to our inner selves. So there was a desperate need for techniques and guides to the inner life, techniques of contemplation. And that's really what happened in the 1960s. I mean, we mentioned this Charles Taylor's phrase, the supernova of spiritual practices. So there was this sudden influx of Eastern contemplative practices into Western culture, Buddhist meditation, Hindu meditation, Taoism, Tai Chi, Hare Krishna, and so on, transcendental meditation, all these different kinds of practices, which became tremendously popular. And have become, and are becoming even more so. So apparently the number of Americans who meditate has gone up from 4% in 2012 to 14% in 2018, which is remarkable, isn't it? That's a tripling of the number of Americans who meditate just in 6 years. So there's been a huge revival of it. Though sometimes people are just taking the technique of mindfulness and using it as a relaxation technique without any of the original ethical context for these practices. Originally, of course, it was connected to the idea of right living and right speech and right livelihood. And now often it's just a kind of technique that you can use to relax yourself, even if you're a pretty bad person. So that's one of the issues I have with modern mindfulness. But in this chapter, I went to a Vipassana retreat, which is a 10-day meditation retreat. I tried that out. I really hadn't had any experience of, or hardly any experience of contemplation before. And I signed up for this retreat. And I looked on the first day, and I looked at the schedule, and I saw that we were expected to do sitting meditation for 10 hours a day. For 10 days, so 100 hours altogether. So this was quite an ordeal. But I also found it a very interesting experience. And I guess I found I grew through it. And since then, I've been on several other retreats. I found them very helpful. I found that they've helped me to become more mindful and I would say a little bit more compassionate as well. I love a kind of contemplation called loving kindness meditation, where it's just basically you wish yourself well, you wish other people well, and then you wish all beings in the universe well. And you do that kind of every day and you get into a habit of kindness. So I'm quite fond of that practice of contemplation. But you know, what I've learned is there are many different types of contemplation, religious, non-religious, atheist, theist, some that use focus on breathing, some which use movement, some which use poetry or art. And I think many of your listeners could find the kind of a practice which suits them, maybe walking meditation, for example. I think there's quite a lot in that chapter that your readers might find interesting and useful.
Excellent. Well, chapter 8 takes a much darker turn to the underbelly of ecstatic experience, and that's the ecstasy of violence and war. And so after the types of encounters we've been discussing so far, this notion is pretty jarring. So first tell us about the four basic sources of ecstatic experience in this context, and then tell us a little bit more about how we can balance that.
God, I can't remember what I said.
Combat, flow, ecstatic togetherness, participation in sacred myth, and blood catharsis.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm talking about in this chapter, the main theme, is that if you look over human history, one of the most reliable methods people have reported to bring themselves to kind of ecstatic experience is violence and war. That could be everything from hunting. You know, the experience of being in a pack hunting gave people this feeling of like ecstatic togetherness with their tribe. And also, there's something about being in a dangerous situation, like a hunt or like a battle, which gives you what I call combat flow. So a flow experience is an experience where you're just very absorbed in the moment, very absorbed in your activity. Well, nothing gives you that kind of flow experience like war and like being in a life-threatening situation. Now, some people get flow states through things like extreme sports. They put themselves in a life-threatening situation like, say, free climbing or just climbing, and it gives them that flow state. But a lot of soldiers will come back from wars and they'll be a bit embarrassed to admit it, but they'll say they never felt so alive than during battle, because not necessarily because they were turned into kind of, you know, bloodlustful berserkers, though sometimes that would happen, but just because they felt their consciousness was so alive because their lives were in danger. And then you sometimes get this idea of sacred myths. So there you see sometimes rather toxic political movements giving people a sense of ecstasy. So extremist movements will do that. They become a kind of alternative religion. So my hero Aldous Huxley said, the great religions of the 19th and the 20th century was actually nationalism. Nationalism was the kind of, you know, the modern alternative to religion. Rather than worshipping God, you worship the state and you worship the national leader. This kind of puffed up strongman strutting on the stage and saying how great he is and how great his country is. And often in those kinds of political religions, they almost have a rally aspect to them. You think about Nazism as fascism is the classic example of this. It was a kind of a fake religion, a religion of worshipping Germany and worshipping the Führer. And you see the kind of ecstasy that people would feel at Nazi rallies. And they were very good at using ritual and pageantry and the huge crowds together. And then Hitler was very good at working the crowd up into this ecstatic fever, all about how wonderful Germany was and the glorious vision for Germany. And then, of course, you also see a demonization of your enemies. It's very easy in these kinds of in any kind of ecstatic movement, you say, you know, we're so together, we're so special and kind of loved, but our enemies are so terrible and demonic. And wouldn't the world be a better place if our enemies were just extinguished? And so you see that today as well. You see the revival of those kinds of ecstatic nationalist movements, and you see the demonization of enemies. Whether that's immigrants or your political opponents or other religions. And then you can get the sense of, you know, the sacred sacrifice of your life to destroy your enemies. So you look at, you know, the idiot in New Zealand who considers himself some kind of sacred knight because he shoots defenseless people in a mosque, or idiot followers of ISIS who think of themselves as kind of, you know, ecstatic martyrs because they've, you know, blown up innocent civilians. So people can get, unfortunately, very poisoned by these kinds of toxic ideologies, which give them a sense of transcendence and meaning and togetherness. So they take these natural human yearnings for togetherness, for meaning and transcendence, but package them in a very toxic form, and really a way that destroys people's lives and then makes them extremely harmful to their society as well. So what's the solution to that then? Well, I guess we need to try to give people healthier forms of togetherness. How can we feed those basic human impulses, our basic needs for togetherness, for belonging, for meaning and transcendence, but in ways that aren't toxic, in ways that don't demonize our enemies? So that is, and one way I think is not to pathologize transcendence, but to see that it is a basic human urge, and we've got to find healthier ways to talk about it and give people access to it. Otherwise, people find these toxic subcultures, and that's where they get their kind of hit of transcendence.
Okay, well, our final stop on our tour here is, you call it Future Land, so it's looking forward. And let's start with cyberspace. We take the internet and our personal computers kind of for granted at this point, but there was a time when these things were thought to offer out-of-body experiences. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I look at the history of Silicon Valley and how the people who developed like the personal computer and the internet and virtual reality tended to be kind of hippies who are experimenting with psychedelics at the same time, and who are kind of looking, they were going and living in communes, like spiritual communes, like Steve Jobs was, for example. I mean, he kind of lived in a commune and picked apples in the orchard, and that's where he got the name for his computer brand. And in some ways, these early pioneers saw cyberspace as a kind of ecstatic space they could escape into, where they'd be free from government and even free from matter, a world of pure mind, of pure information. And they thought of kind of technology like the computer and the internet as being these technologies for ecstasy, which would help liberate us from the bonds of our nation and our government, and even from our own bodies. And I guess you can see that to some extent, the way that we can just go online and we can be whoever we want to be online. We can be whatever shape we want to be online. You know, we can invent avatars for ourselves, connect with people all over the world in a second. And so there is something kind of, I guess, spiritual and ecstatic about that. But in a way, I think, like with every route to ecstasy, there are risks as well. And we've seen that. What are the risks then? Well, the risks are of ecstatic technology, of the worship of technology, is we become addicts. That's true of every form of ecstasy, potentially. We can become addicted to drugs or booze. We can become addicted to ecstatic religion. We can become addicted to war and violence. And we definitely can become addicted to technology as well. You know, we just, every time we feel a bit unhappy, we stare in a trance at our smartphones or at our laptops. And we kind of, they in some ways, they take us out of ourselves, but they don't take us very far. And likewise, I think we've seen over the last decade or so that we were a bit naive and over-optimistic in thinking that the internet was just going to liberate us from all our human problems. Because what we found, unfortunately, was our problems came with us online. And in sometimes these these ecstatic platforms for togetherness ended up just taking us further apart. So sometimes you see on platforms like Facebook and Twitter, we ended up just still in our little separate churches. You'd have Democratic Twitter or Republican Twitter, and they'd both end up feeling very much together with your own tribe, but hating the opposing tribes and being very rude and savage to each other. So in some ways, technology, I feel, kind of offered us a type of failed transcendence. But of course, it's early days. I'm still interested and hopeful about how technology can still help us find healthier forms of transcendence. I'm very interested to see how virtual reality will develop. And at the most simple way, for example, I still use my smartphone to help me find a kind of healthier transcendence. So I have like a kind of meditation app on my phone, which I use every morning. And that helps me just to meditate, for example. I think often we found that technology isn't quite the perfect route to transcendence that we hoped it might be in the 80s and 90s, but I'm still interested in how it can help us today.
Well, Jules, I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come on the show. But before we go, can you tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on?
Yeah, sure. I'm working on a couple of things. I'm co-editing a book about spiritual emergencies. That's basically a moment of an ecstatic experience, a moment of awakening, which is quite messy and may involve you just feeling quite disorientated and even involve some kind of quasi-psychotic aspects like mania or sleeplessness or even kind of hearing voices and things like that. Basically, I'm interested in how we can help people through those kinds of messy awakening experiences. So I'm co-editing a book about that, which is going to come open later this year. It's called Breaking Open, Navigating Spiritual Emergencies. I've written a little book about ayahuasca, which is a type of psychedelic drug. That book's going to be called Holiday from the Self. And it's kind of a personal account of a rather tempestuous ayahuasca experience I had a couple of years ago. It's a funny little travel book. And then I'm researching a book about Aldous Huxley. So I have a website, philosophyforlife.org, which listeners can go and check out. And that has a kind of a free newsletter, which you can sign up for. Seeing as we've gone through the whole book, I could just give the kind of conclusion of it. The conclusion of it really is after 5 years of searching for ecstatic experiences, I decided that what we really need in our culture is not necessarily just more ecstatic experiences, but a more balanced attitude to them. So I think that we can make two mistakes in Western culture in our relationship to ecstasy. The first mistake, and it's a very common one, is we're too afraid of losing control. We are afraid of going beyond the ego. We're in a culture which is often rather very stuck in our egos and afraid of going beyond them because we don't want to look ridiculous and we don't want to go mad. So as a result, we can be very averse to ecstasy. And that's one risk. And the risk of that is you end up just stuck in your little ego, feeling bored, depressed, and claustrophobic and never really surrendering to anything greater than oneself. So that's the first risk. The second risk, and this is a risk you see in subcultures like the New Age culture and the psychedelic culture, is that we become over-attached to ecstasy. We end up chasing it. We end up just constantly searching for the next spiritual high, for the next psychedelic high, for the next kind of, you know, Holy Spirit type encounter. And I saw that a lot in the kind of New Age culture, where there's almost a fetishization of special ecstatic experiences. And that is a risk too, to become over attached to ecstasy and think that actually the meaning of life is these ecstatic experiences. Well, that's not true as far as I'm concerned. These experiences aren't good or bad in themselves. They can sometimes be very helpful in giving, in helping people to heal, in helping them connect to other people, and in giving them a sense of meaning in life. But you know, they can sometimes be helpful in making you kinder and wiser. But they're no, there's no essential value to them in themselves. And if you have one of these experiences, then just think you're very special because you've had an ecstatic experience, then you've actually become a worse person. You've become just more proud, more arrogant. So the proper attitude to these kinds of experiences is actually neither to be averse to them because they're just natural and they just happen to humans naturally, or to be over-attached to them and think you're very special for having these experiences, but rather to be balanced, to have an attitude of equanimity, which is these experiences happen, but they're neither good or bad in themselves. It's the use to which you put them and whether you let them make you become a kinder and wiser person. So that was really the conclusion I arrived at in this book.
Oh, that's very nice. I like that. That's a lovely note to go off on. Well, thank you again. I really enjoyed our conversation. I was glad to have a chance to talk with you about your wonderful book in person. So thanks again, Jules.
Thank you for having me, Carrie. I've enjoyed the conversation too.
I want to thank you for listening to New Books in Secularism, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Once again, I'm Carrie Lynn Evans, and I've been speaking with Jules Evans, no relation, about his book, The Art of Losing Control, A Philosopher's Search for Ecstatic Experience. If you enjoyed this podcast, please write us a positive review on iTunes, post about us on social media, or tell a friend. The New Books Network is a not-for-profit organization, so all the buzz you can help us generate goes a long way to supporting this work. I'm also interested in hearing from you about your thoughts on this podcast and the material we cover. I would love to hear from you about your thoughts on this book. Have you had a spontaneous spiritual experience before? Or does cathartic ecstasy have any role in your life now or at any time? You can find me on Twitter at Carrie Lynn Land. That's at CarrieLynnLand. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you have a book you'd like covered on one of our shows? Contact us through our website, newbooksnetwork.com. Also, be sure to like the New Books in Secularism channel on Facebook and Twitter, where you'll see every time we post a new interview. In the meantime, I'll wish you an au revoir until my next conversation about New Books in Secularism.